Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. BBC journalist Mohamed Hashim returned to his home city of Omdurman in Sudan for the first time since the war broke out in April 2023. We'll hear a first-hand account of what he saw there.
They were all speaking about the hardships that they endured when their areas were controlled by the Rapid Support Forces.
And how to save a language on the verge of extinction, we'll hear from a teacher who's preserving the Yakunte language in Kenya and how it's done.
We always say in a week, because we have 300 people, we plant 300 trees. The students, as you go around the forest, can learn the language around. So you can see a word and see the other side, it's translated. So the environment can teach even people.
It's Wednesday, October 16th. First, we go to Nigeria.
This is Focus on Africa on BBC News. Our top stories. Almost half of Nigeria's Borno State capital is underwater after a dam burst its banks, worsening an ongoing humanitarian crisis.
Over the past few months, West and Central Africa have been experiencing severe floods that have affected millions of people. In September, a dam collapsed following torrential rains in northeastern Nigeria, leading to many losing their lives, homes and livelihoods. Unstable weather patterns due to climate change are also worsening Nigeria's food insecurity. As the world marks World Food Day today, the BBC's Azizat Ola Olua visited two farms in the northeast to see how drought and floods are causing poor harvests. She saw how huge investments by farmers is lost due to low yield at a time when the country is grappling with double-digit food inflation. Azizat, thank you for your time. Start by describing where you went to and what you saw, how climate change is impacting food production and farming in Nigeria.
Thank you very much, Charles. You know, floods have affected about 29 states in Nigeria. So it's actually a huge problem the country is facing this year. And Northeast Nigeria, the region that is facing insecurity, experienced another disaster when it comes to this flood, and then drought as well. So some of the hardest hit states are Adamawa, Taraba, in terms of drought. So we thought to go to these two states that would, you know, be able to show us the extreme weather patterns that farmers are experiencing, you know, in the farming states. So first of all, we went to Adamawa State, where we met with a 55-year-old widow, Memafua, who has been farming for about 25 years. And she said the last 5 years have been the most challenging for her as a farmer, you know. And then this year, takes the cherry, on, you know, because she lost everything, first of all, to drought. The earlier part of the year, when she planted her crops, she was hoping they would germinate, but they didn't because, you know, there was no rain. And then all the crops wilted, and we could see the vivid proof of that on her farm. And then a few months later, the rain started, and she thought that she would be able to get something out of it this time. She planted again, but the floods came and washed away everything. You know, being there on the farm with her was quite emotional, because I tried to situate myself in a position. On one part of our farm, you see these wilted crops that had grown so high. And then on the other part of the farm, you see the land flooded. She said when she got there, she was just confused and sad.
I suffered from drought. A few months later, when my farm began to yield, floods came and destroyed the whole farm. I am not happy because now I am unable to provide for my family.
That is Mema Fua, who has been farming for 25 years. Azizat, you also visited Rabiu Musa. What's his story and how has he been impacted?
He's been impacted extensively as well. For Mema, first of all, she now has a high blood pressure because of her experience. For Rabiu, he says he has a headache that has refused to go away because of constant brooding over his financial loss. Rabiu has about 30 hectares of land and he was expecting to harvest about 30 bags of maize. So imagine what he's going through at the moment. He even got a loan, you know, to farm during the farming season, expecting high yield, and now drought happened. For 40 days, he said they didn't get rainfall, which, you know, made all the crops to die. Now he's in debt. He has about 40 dependents, you know, waiting for him to provide for them. His children cannot go to school. His wives are hungry as well. He said he's just living by the thread.
We fasted. We shared maize with people seeking God's mercy. Many people lost their investments and others gave up. Honestly, I am not happy. Whenever I go to my farm, I normally come back with headache. I feel like I am going to fall down.
So that's Rabiu Musa. I mean, Azizat, it's very personal and very painful experiences of these farmers in Nigeria. But do we know to what extent farmlands in the country have been, destroyed by the flooding? You talked of 29 states. Do this include some of the key food producing states for Nigeria?
Absolutely. And that's why there's a worry that the country's already bad situation around food insecurity could get worse because of this year's intense flooding. It's really worrisome. What I saw on the ground worries me deeply because for Mema's community, for example, it's a farming community. Almost all the farmers there are impacted. Almost all of them lost their crops this year. They are not able to farm. So imagine many people that are supposed to supply a particular region with food after harvest are unable to do so. It means that the people that are going to go hungry. Mind you, most of these communities are not even in the middle class. They are below the middle class. They are already affected economically. So most of them, even they farm what they feed on. So now that they are unable to do so, it's extremely worrisome. And that's what the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations is saying, that the numbers might even be higher, what they've projected for the country, that about 22 million Nigerians could be food insecure, would go hungry this year alone.
We do hear often about global warming and, you know, climate change. What specifically is causing these extreme weather patterns in West Africa and Nigeria specifically?
Well, what we've heard about the unstable weather conditions is that it's the global phenomenon, like you said, climate change, greenhouse gas emission. But unfortunately, like we've heard many times, Africa is not even contributing to the greenhouse gas emission, but the continent is really one of the continents that is impacted negatively by the effects of climate change. And what are the results of that? You're seeing that during the rainy season, the rains are delayed. And then when you're supposed to get into the maybe the dry season, the rains come heavily, flooding lands and washing away croplands as well, which is now impacting on food production of the country.
Did you see perhaps any signs of adaptation or new farming techniques that are being used to help farmers get through this?
Honestly, I didn't see any because, you know, Nigeria is a very big place. The government will say they are doing one thing, but on the ground, you see something totally different. Of course, they are doing something, but how many farmers are directly benefiting from what the government is doing? I spoke to the commissioner for the environment in Adamawa State, Memafa State, and he said that the authorities have set up a food insecurity committee because they understand and they've identified that it's actually a huge problem, that at the moment they cannot even produce enough food for them to consume in the state, let alone export to other parts of the country. So they say they are working on it. They are talking to a research institute to give them drought-resistant seedlings. But there's lots of education that has to go into that because most farmers, especially in northern Nigeria, they are not really educated. They're not into mechanized farming, so to speak. They still use people, you know, laborers on their farm, or they do the tilling themselves with their children. So seeing them adopting climate smart agriculture is not something that is pronounced across the region just yet.
And we have an idea of what the government plans to do at a national level to help the farming communities and also just save the food insecurity that Nigeria is now under threat of?
Well, the federal government say that they are working to alleviate the suffering of the people. They have, in time past, you know, released rice to states, wheat to states. But when it comes to climate resilience, we've not really heard so much about it. But I spoke to the country representative of the of FAO, like I said earlier, and he said that they're actually working with the Minister of Agriculture to provide some solutions on the ground in affected states.
This climate change caused a huge economic deficit to the farmers. We need to shift for agriculture to climate smart agriculture, introducing innovation, introducing water management and water control.
And Azizat, do you get a sense that the agricultural sector in Nigeria can realistically adapt to climate change? Or could we say we are witnessing the beginning of a much larger crisis for food security in the region?
I want to say yes to both questions. Nigeria is a very big country and we have many farmers. It's one thing for government to put policies in place. It's another thing for them to implement it, to have direct impact on those that are producing this food in the country, because they could bring out numbers and say that, okay, this is the kind of support we're giving people. 50 farmers are directly benefiting 100 farmers. But when you go to the ground like I did, you will see a totally different story. It's possible for us to be able to get to where it's expected in order for them to, you know, put these climate shocks in place to protect food production mechanism. But it takes a lot of genuineness on the part of the authorities for this to work.
What are the experts saying as to how this situation will play out?
They're pretty much saying the same thing, really, that if authorities do not act fast or they do not stay the course on what they are doing at the moment or increase their efforts, things could get worse next year. I spoke to a trader in Adamawa who complained that in her own village that they did not see enough rain, that she had to travel to go buy her product, maize, in another village. When she got there, she saw that they were experiencing drought. So she had to spend double the amount she would naturally spend to buy two bags of maize, rather, to buy one. And she was lamenting that next year things could get worse if things don't change. You can only protect yourself by being smart about it. And that's why these climate solutions are very imperative for people to move forward. Unfortunately, many farmers, especially local farmers, do not really trust the solution, especially when it comes to genetically modified seedlings that authorities are trying to sell to them, because there is a financial commitment to it. You cannot reuse the seedlings produced by crops from genetically modified seedlings. You will have to keep buying them annually. And farmers, most of them do not really feel comfortable, you know, trying to put themselves in such a corner where they know that every year they'll be spending more just to farm.
Azizat, thank you for your time and thank you for bringing us the story.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The BBC's Azizat Ola Olua. And now to Sudan. For the past 18 months, the country has suffered a deadly and destructive war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF for short. The war has given rise to the worst displacement crisis in the world, with more than 12 million people having been forced to flee their homes. According to estimates by the United Nations, up to 150,000 people may have been killed. Both the army and the RSF stand accused of violating human rights. It's worth reminding you that the city of Omdurman was among the early victims of this war, having fallen into the hands of the RSF. But in February this year, the Sudanese armed forces recaptured it. My colleague, Mohanad Hashim, was born and grew up in Omdurman. It's where most of his family lived before being displaced by the war. He recently returned to the city after 3 years and saw firsthand how the events of the past year and a half have changed everything he knew about his home. How did you feel just arriving there? But firstly, I should ask, how did you get there and how did it feel to be there?
I'm someone who grew up in Khartoum. And when I say Khartoum, I mean a city that's made out of three cities, Khartoum, Omdurman, and Khartoum North. And I've been living outside in the UK for over 25 years. When I went back to Sudan, I always flew into Khartoum and then did the drive from Khartoum across the Nile into Omdurman. This time around, it was a very different arrival to Sudan. I arrived in Port Sudan, which is the country's de facto capital. And Port Sudan is on the Red Sea, and it's about 820 kilometers by road to get from Port Sudan to the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. So it's a long distance to travel. And traveling that distance at a time of war would mean that you encounter a lot of checkpoints. And what you would have done normally in an 8-hour or 10-hour drive in one day, it requires 2 days. You have to make a stopover in Adbara or Shendi in the north. Generally, it was a very different visit because you start meeting people in Port Sudan who've been displaced because of the war, people who are struggling, who sleep in rough, or people who are in sort of like IDP, internally displaced persons camps, who are staying in schools or staying out in the open, and seeing children who are struggling with their health, their being malnourished because they're not having enough food to eat. It's worth to keep in mind that this is the world's worst humanitarian disaster, with more than 10 million people displaced within the country.
And how did that compare with when you had left the city, you know, before there was all this war going on?
I mean, the thing is that you have to keep in mind, Charles, is Khartoum, and as the Sudanese capital, was home to something between 8 and 10 million people. It had the largest concentration of businesses, of schools, of universities, of clinics, of factories, of government offices. So the fact that this horrible war started off in the Sudanese capital meant that there has been an extensive destruction of the infrastructure. Khartoum was also quite an affluent city. Now you see the extent to which the city has been looted and pillaged. Life has completely changed in the city. There are enclaves where there is semblances of normalcy, like in northern Omdurman. Then there are other parts that don't have electricity, don't have running water, don't have open shops, no clinics, checkpoints everywhere, and still soldiers are working, like in my neighborhood, which is completely deserted because most of the residents of my neighborhood have fled either to other parts of Sudan or abroad. And then you have parts that are still on the front line. And there is also a large part of the country that is still, or of the city, that's controlled by the RSF. And since the war started, very few journalists have had access to RSF-controlled areas in the capital. So life has completely changed in the city. It's not the same city that I left when I left Sudan in September 2021.
You met up with your family, your friends, especially you did meet your mother's cousin and your auntie as well. What did they tell you as to what has been happening to them all this time since April 2023 and how they have had to survive day to day?
In the case of my relatives that I met in my neighborhood when I went back, their situation and their stories were similar to stories that people were sharing in different parts of Omdurman that I met.
I check in on my mother's cousin, Mamoun. He's a retired banker that chose not to leave his house. He survived the month this area was controlled by the RSF. They even mistook his identity for an army officer and arrested him for a few days. His house was hit by mortar fire twice, and a shrapnel is still in his arm. I leave Mamoun to visit my second cousin, Wafa.
She stayed alone in the house with a couple of ladies, and I don't know what she's going to tell me, and I don't think she's expecting me, so it's going to be a surprise for her. Assalamu alaikum.
They were all speaking about the hardships that they endured when their areas were controlled by the rapid support forces. And in the case of my aunt, she was telling me how she had to stand up to the various groups of RSF fighters that will come to her house trying to, whether to take anything of value, be it furniture or gold or money or things like that, or whether they'll come and they want to make a move at one of the maids who was working with her. So generally, I think people have endured a lot. The scale of the traumatic experiences is beyond imagination, and we only scratch the surface. And whenever you speak to someone, what people often tell you is that
we've learned our lesson, but we can't live with the RSF. What do they mean when they say we've learned our lesson? It's open to interpretation, but they're very clear in their inability to live with or under the RSF.
So you also went to your old house, the place where you lived before leaving Sudan. How was that moment for you? How did you feel about it and what you found there?
It was very crushing going to visit my grandfather's house where I lived. Very crushing because you feel that your own personal memories have been desecrated.
I'm looking at the house before I go inside because I feel it's going to be heavy. Let's go into the house, I guess. I mean, you can see several of my cousins left their cars in here. Everything has been looted or destroyed or damaged.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Look at the destruction of it. Thank God that the pictures and the photographs are here.
My house was used as a military sort of base. In the basement, you can still smell the smell of gunpowder, where they clearly were storing ammunition. I stumbled onto a diary that was kept by the RSF commander who was stationed in our house. It was a diary that covered the best part of 3 months, where there were names of individuals, how many soldiers they had under their command, where they were stationed, and what sort of rations they were getting on any given day. And you realize that there were senior commanders who were overseeing the destruction of this private property. And this story is repeated over and over and over and over. What happened to our house is relatively minimal in contrast to other people who'd had their houses burnt or destroyed or completely just ransacked and pulled apart.
So looking at the city itself then, Omdurman, and you've mentioned that it's actually within a city, the larger city or the larger Khartoum area. Looking at what you saw there, do you get any signs that one or the other side of this war is gaining an upper hand in the conflict?
Incidentally, as we left Khartoum on the 25th of September. On the 26th of September, the Sudanese army began what is considered by now the largest offensive in the capital, where they crossed 3 bridges from Omdurman into Khartoum North, 1 bridge from Omdurman into Khartoum North, and then 2 bridges from Omdurman into Khartoum proper. And the past couple of weeks have seen what some would say are small gains by the military, but they are quite significant. The fact that the Sudanese army has now taken the fight to Khartoum proper in an attempt to dislodge the RSF from its strong defensive positions suggests that the army is on a push. Now, this coincides with the end of the rainy season across Sudan. Many suspect that the intensity of the fighting will increase. And what we have seen over the last 2-3 weeks would be considered advances by the Sudanese armed forces. So it's anybody's guess at the moment, but at this particular moment as we're speaking right now, it seems that the Sudanese armed forces have the upper hand in operations across the country.
Mohanad Hashim, back from Sudan. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Africa is home to a third of the world's languages, and at least 75 of them are spoken by more than 1 million people. However, some are slowly dying, and today we are going to focus on the Yankunte, a language spoken by the Yaku community, one of the smallest tribes in Kenya. Yankunte was identified by UNESCO to be at a severe risk of becoming extinct, with only 9 people being able to speak it at one point. Now, that's a very, very small number. But today, more people can speak the language due to the efforts of one Juliana Loshiro, who learned Yankunte from her grandfather. She now spends her time teaching hundreds of children and adults how to speak the language, preserve the Yaku culture, and the environment they live in.
I'm Kenyan and I've never heard of this language. I'd like you to start, Juliana, by just greeting us or teaching us a simple greeting in this Yankute language.
We say echei, and then we respond by saying eow.
So echei, and then you say yao.
Eow, eow. Not yao, but eow.
Eow.
Yeah.
How do you say thank you?
Ke eko.
Ke eko. Okay.
Yeah.
So give us then a bit of a background about how you grew up, where you grew up, and how you learned this language.
I grew up in Mkogodo Forest, being raised up by my grandfather, who is currently among us the last fluent speaker at the age of 113 years old. He taught me the language when I was just 7 years after my parents passed away. What inspired me so much is my grandfather's dream. He believed that losing our language means losing our identity and the connection to our land.
So yes. Then, Juliana, at what point did you learn that your language, the Yankunte, is endangered? And how was that moment for you?
My grandfather have started teaching me the language, and when he introduced me, he did as a story. We always have storytellings for each and every homestead. And as we were just there at the bonfire, he told me, I have something to share with you. Many kids came for the storytelling in our home. And he told me, I have learned something, and I should tell you at your own young age that we have lost the language and the culture. And I really feel very pain that we no longer have the language. I want to teach you the language in a hard way. If you'll not be getting the words, I'll teach you 10 words a day. You will not have food. I used to sleep outside whenever I don't get the language. There was a time I slept hungry. So I learned the language in hard way. And from that, I realized, my grandfather is right. I dropped out of school. I told my grandfather, because I will not continue anymore walking to school 6 kilometers. I stopped at night, and during the day, I feel like I'll faint. And then he was like, I want you to faint, and then I'll give you some milk. When you wake up, I'll tell you that's how the language is. The language is tough and the language is dead. But when you will learn the language and when you will go and help the children, you'll help your community in future. When I always see the language is dead, I'm also dead spiritually. But if the language is alive, I become young every day.
Just explain to us how you ended up learning the Ma language, which is what the Maasai people in Kenya speak. And it's a large community of people going all the way into Tanzania. So how is it that your community sort of, to say, got swallowed up by this large community, and most of young people from the Yaku community then ended up speaking a different language that's not their own?
Over the 20th century, changes in social structures led us now to be assimilated. The nearby, as you are saying, the Maasai community was assimilated as were pastoralists. We had to adapt to the Ma language and their culture. They enticed us with the bridewell, the one they usually give during the intermarriages. And also, there is this story that I've been through, like I've been given by my grandparents, about the Maoko who killed the Yaku community during the migration. When they were coming to Mkogodo, they met the people who were called the Maoko, and they killed many, many people, thousands of Yaku community. And through the fear, they also feared that the Maasai would also kill them. They named one of the mountains as Tuludimtu. The Maasai call it Donyele Sarge. That is mountain of blood, the red mountain. So they always believe, even the Maasai believe, that it is the mountain that the Yaku community were killed. So what made our language and the culture lost is the threat, and also the killing, the massive killing that happened for our community. So that's what made our language and the culture lost, and we decided to adapt to the Maasai language.
So there are a number of factors, including the sort of the traditional conquests that would happen back in the day and intermarriages and things like that. Your grandfather is a very tough teacher, but tell us how you do the teaching yourself. Tell us all about it.
We have already constructed the school. By the help of the grandfather, he gave us a 4-acre. It's a shed for the community to come and sit and learn the language. I'm a teacher by profession, and I abandoned my career for the sake of saving the language. And since as the only fluent speaker, I decided to bring board members, that's the elders, the youth council, and also my sister, that is Rachel Malka, who we converse now in Nyaku language. We decided to have a program. That is a program that we run from Monday to Saturday. So far, so good. We have 472 students that we have enrolled. For now, the interest is growing, but we have a 42 right. class that is fully concentrated that will be graduating in some years to come. In 2 years from now, they'll be graduating from the language.
Your lessons are more than just saving the Yaku language. It's also about preserving the culture. How important is this forest for the culture? You can start by telling us the name of the forest and how important it is for the culture.
Mkugudo Forest is really important for our culture since we are the custodians and this is our ancestral home where we have been brought up in. And we have been taught more of like in a tradition aspect, let me say, for our spiritual being, for the medicinal purposes, for our food. So the forest means a lot. It's more of also climatic changes that are happening on the universe. Like we bring this thing to the kids, like it's a climate change thing and we teach them. It's more, not more of just language. We just speak of language, but we are up to protecting our mother nature, which is now we believe that we have been blessed by the mother nature to have our Mkogodo forest that is now we should take care of.
Okay. And then you're also planting trees while you teach.
Yeah.
This language, how do the two work together?
We incorporated environmental education by taking students to the forest to plant indigenous trees, whereby each tree is labeled in Yakunte in English, creating what we call a word forest dictionary. So far, we have planted 50,000 trees, aiming for each and every week, whereby we always say in a week because we have 300 people, we plant 300 trees. We usually say that if we lack forest, we lack water. If we lack water, we lack our culture, which is connected to our honey. If we lost our honey, that is, we'll not have anything to place on table. And if we lost all these, we will be dead. And if we'll die, no one will be to protect nature. So the word forest dictionary came into our idea where we can incorporate it. And through that, the students, as you go around the forest, you can learn the language around. So you can see a word and see the other side, it's translated. So without a teacher, the environment can teach even people.
How long do you think it would take to sort of pull out this Yankunte language out of the extinction that it's been facing until this initiative that you launched?
Every year we do exams and we have already targeted for ourselves. In 5 years, we'll have complete teachers, we'll have complete people to help us now to spread it. And like in 5 years, the halfway of the community will know the language, which will support us to help others know it.
Okay, Juliana, let me see if I remember what you taught me at the beginning of the interview. So to say thank you is Keiko.
Good. Shahaunete. If you want to tell someone you are welcome, you say Shahaunete.
Many thanks to Juliana Loshiro. Focus on Africa was put together by Nyasha Michelle, Patricia Whitehorn, Yvette Togira Maria, and Noor Abida in London. Blessing Aderuba did her bit from Lagos. Paul Bachibinga was a senior producer, and Francesca Dan was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi. Thanks for listening.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.